The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Warkey, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Now calling the case of Woolsey versus Woolsey, A20-0749.
Good morning, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And we are going to follow our standard protocol, which is each side has 15 minutes if you choose to use it, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The case is being recorded, so please state your name at the beginning of your argument. And with that, we are ready for appellant's argument.
Perfect. Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Steve Hennick, and may it please the court, I represent appellant Jonathan Woolsey in this matter. The facts are relatively straightforward. I won't spend a lot of time on them, but just to frame my argument, I'd like to highlight a couple of them. This involves the party's one daughter, Emma. When they divorced in 2015, she was 21 months old, and she's now 6 years old. The issue presented in this appeal relates to award of joint legal custody. And as you're aware, but to frame my argument, legal custody relates to decisions about children's schooling, their medical care, and their religious.
Mr. Hennick, I'm going to interrupt you. I think the fact records of this are pretty clear to all of us. It looks as if there was a lot of issues in terms of decision making back in the day. But here's what bothers me about this case and where I keep coming back.
Okay.
I've always been annoyed in my former days as a trial court judge when attorneys would craft a stipulation that would kick a can down the road. In other words, you couldn't get it fixed back then, so let's just pick a date 5 years down or whatever it was in this case, and then we'll have at it again and we'll forget what the statute says. We're just gonna leapfrog right in to where we would have been had we been in that place before. I mean, it's a way of making concessions. And I guess what I'm getting at is, what authority do lawyers rely on? What authority are you relying on? What can you point me to that says attorneys and litigants have the ability to kind of really end run a statute by doing this? Are there any cases that say that this is okay? Frankly, if I was a trial judge in this, I would have said, no, here we are. This is your day in court, figure it out now. We're not gonna preserve this little gem under a different standard just to get a settlement. But tell me what's the most compelling authority that I can follow saying that that is a permissible option.
Well, Your Honor, I share your frustration as well. And I understand that. One, I think it happens routinely, but two, in other areas of the law, the statutes certainly allow parties to control even the jurisdiction of the court. Say on a spousal maintenance claim, they can say, this court never has jurisdiction to decide this or change this. There's language in 518.1.8, which allows a provision for the parties to do and modify their legal burden. So I think there's a statutory basis to do this in 518.18 that allows them to do this under 518.17 period. There isn't anything in 518.17, the best interest analysis, which is applied on the initial setting, that says that. But in other areas of family law, it occurs relatively routinely, like I said, with a parallel spousal maintenance claim. Jurisdiction can even be waived of the trial court to say you can never, ever change the agreement that we reach. And so
if that is the case and you have an agreement, which we all are aware of and read, I mean, it does not specifically state in that agreement that you don't have the prima facie burden before you get to what you've agreed to. And I'm not sure I agree with what you get to by the agreement, but even so, if that language is lacking, what do we do about that? I mean, that's the thrust of your argument today.
Well, I think it's important to understand what the parties agreed to first and then what they didn't agree to. And to the extent possible, the district court is bound by the previous district court order, which is the party's agreement back in 2015. And they had a relatively straightforward agreement and the court adopted that. I don't think that the trial court in 2020 has the ability to second guess what the trial court, a different judge, did in 2015 by adopting the agreement. So my view would be the trial court's responsibility in 2020, whether they liked it or not, was to simply abide by the party's agreement and conduct a de novo review under the statute that the parties agreed to, understood, and the court ordered that. Neither party appealed that order. That time frame has long since passed.
Do you think that it would be suitable for the Court of Appeals to make such a determination and state that a secondary hearing judge, I mean, I understand being bound by case law, but when we have this kind of a circumstance that it's permissible for attorneys to agree to something that's outside of the statutory norms?
Well, I'm not sure that it's outside the statutory
norms. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is you're saying this happens all the time. And I say, yeah, I'm aware of it. I'm frustrated by it. And I used to say, no, figure it out. So if it happens all the time, shouldn't we as an appellate court, that's my question, should we as an appellate court give some guidance to the trial court judges on what they should or shouldn't do under these circumstances?
Well, I don't know that this is the case quite for that. It doesn't present wide-ranging other applications. I do think that there is some statutory basis to do what the parties did. Otherwise, so I would just point you to 518.18 subdivision D. And so if you look at 518.18 subdivision D, which relates to a modification, if you consider it a modification, it's clear that the legislature allows litigants to change their legal standard of review. So if you look at 518.18 subdivision D, it allows parties to do this very thing. These parties did something I think a little different than that. They said we're going to lower the legal burden, but we're going to strictly apply a 518.17 analysis and review this, as you say, Your Honor, kick the can down the road to see what the facts are in 5 years. I think as a practical matter, the parties had hoped that with the addition of time and further evidence and further agreements of the parties that they could have perhaps a better idea on what the appropriate legal custody designation could be there. So I think there was probably some reason when you have such a small, an infant at that time going through the process that it might be helpful for a trial court to be able to look back in time and look back at their more of a history of these parties in 2020 to say, how have they done? And is it in this child's best interest?
That may be true, but that's also why we have guidance in terms of how something gets reviewed by the district court. Don't we take into consideration judicial efficiency, that if parties in any circumstance can agree to just move on for the point of stopping their fees, perhaps, or move on just because they perhaps are remarrying or something is happening, and then always, well, we're going to come back again and we'll fight it out then. I mean, shouldn't judicial efficiency be taken into consideration? Well, if we don't have the threshold that you can have it heard again with good reason if you have met your prima facie burden.
So, I was trying to understand your question, and I'm sorry if I didn't quite.
Well, you can obviously tell I'm very focused on the nuances of what was done versus where it's at. I mean, our court will deal with what the agreement was, and we'll apply the legal analysis as best we can. But what I'm getting at is from a policy standpoint, I still cringe at the thought that attorneys can just not guide their clients to some final conclusion, because we always work towards judicial efficiency. And that's the reason you have the ability to bring a case back before a court when a child is now 6 years old, but you have to make that prima facie showing before you get into court. So how do we just step around the failure to show up, have a prima facie showing?
As a policy matter or in this particular case, Your Honor?
In this particular case, I'll leave you alone on the policy.
Well, I'm happy to, the extent I can, address
this. This is something I'd like to debate at great length, but not in the context of this particular case,
because yeah,
the case, of course, the parties need an answer to this matter. But thank
you. I think that would be wise, Your Honor. I would say that in this case, I wasn't the trial lawyer, neither was Ms. Novelli or Ms. Appelhoff, who we dealt with kind of the aftermath of this, and nor was the trial court judge. So I don't know what led into that. If your question relates to, did the trial court in 2015 have the authority to bind these parties to their agreement, I suggest that they did, and they have it based upon 518.18, which clearly allows people to reduce the legal burden on a subsequent motion. So my view, that's exactly what they did in this case. And whether the trial court in 2020 liked it or not, I think they were bound to what the agreement was and what the existing court order said. And unfortunately, I don't think that this trial court did that, for lack of a better reason, or lack of a better saying. If this is the frustration I have in reading the 2020 trial court's order is that the trial court makes a finding that this is a de novo review, yet then does not conduct a de novo review under the very statute that the parties agreed the de novo review be. And so if you look at 518.17, it's clear that if there is a de novo review or an initial setting, the trial court has to do certain things, which is consider each one of those 12 factors, make a specific finding as to each one of those factors, make a determination of how those factors impact the child, and come up with a ruling and explain to the parties why they came to the conclusion of joint legal custody or sole legal custody.
Mr. Henry, we have a number of cases like the Seuss case and In Re Custody of JWVH and In Re Marriage of Hill, where the parties had, from what I can tell, the same agreement that the two parties here had, which was to look at best interest, and yet our court affirmed the district court, who said, but you have to make this prima facie showing first under 518. So what do we do with those cases? I realize that they are non-precedential, and yet they provide fairly clear guidance.
They do, but I'm not sure in this case, Your Honor, that they have the same agreement. And when I read those cases, it's difficult to see if they have the exact same language and stipulation. As I read them, I was not sure about that. And from my perspective, I don't think they did, in trying to read around what all the specific facts were. And so from my perspective, again, what the parties agreed to was clear, that they didn't intend for there to be this prima facie showing. They simply said, we're going to look back with fresh eyes under a de novo review with the ability to now know what happened in those 5 years to then do what's right for this child. And so the cases you cited, the unpublished ones, I don't think we have the same agreement as a comparison. So I think these parties did something really specific, which was say, we're not deciding this issue. We're going to let my client, in a specific time frame, ask the court to decide those issues, and we're going to use this standard. And it didn't include a 518.18 standard. It said 518.17. And so I'm not sure that those cases are applicable here, and you can make that distinction, that this was a different agreement and a different 2015 court order than those cases. in the alternative, I see my time has run short. If you were to say that we're going to apply a prima facie showing for a best interest case, it's when you look at the record of a whole, it's my view that the trial court abused its discretion by not making that prima facie, by not finding that my client met that prima facie burden. The record is replete with not only allegations of a change in circumstance, but factual change in circumstance, as well as my client alleging in his affidavit that there has been a change in circumstance. And for this court to, the trial court only gave like two small little findings, I think there were 18 and 19, that don't cover the broad range of a best interest finding, I believe is an abuse of discretion. And I see my time is at zero, but I'm happy to talk again about that with my rebuttal time if necessary or requested.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And now we'll hear from attorney for.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay, I'll start where you kind of left off. You know, I think this case is extremely similar to the facts in Olinger v. Beckman, which is an unpublished case that Judge Riley referenced earlier, where the parties didn't indicate whether 518.18d would apply. They merely said that a modification of custody would be under the best interest standard. And what this court found in that case is that the parties agree to allow the modification when it's in the best interest of the child, and the parties intended to give effect to the option allowed by Minnesota statute 518.18d, Roman numeral one. Nothing in 518D suggests that you get to opt out of the requirement for a substantial change in circumstances to be shown. Nothing in the party's agreement. There's no language that says that they are opting out of 518.18D Roman numeral one's requirement that in order to get a modification approved, you have to prove a substantial change in circumstances, and then you get to the best interest analysis. What they did was change the basis or the theory for the modification from endangerment, which would have otherwise been applicable, up to best interest. But you don't opt out of 518.18d just because you agree under 518.18di that the best interest standard is applicable. So I think that, I mean, the district, and this is in line with several unpublished cases by this court. I mean, there's not a whole lot of situations in family law where parties make these types of agreements. So I'm not terribly surprised there's a dearth of litigation specifically on point, but this Olinger case is, I mean, it's directly on point. So, I mean, I'm not as frustrated as I think Judge Work is with the attorneys in this case, because I think that they did clearly indicate that a modification would be under 518.18d subdivision one. And in order to trigger that, you do have to prove a substantial change. I disagree with opposing counsel that that a substantial change, even if everything in the father's affidavits is deemed accurate, that he has proven any kind of substantial change. What he argued in his affidavit, what he showed, is that he has a close and loving relationship with the child. That's not a substantial change. And that the parties have been able to, in his opinion, reach some agreements on some issues regarding the child. That's not a substantial change either. There's a lot of context provided by a respondent in this case regarding how the parties make agreements, what agreements were actually made, that is relevant and that the court did and is permitted to take into consideration. So, I mean, it's very clear that 518.18d requires a substantial change in circumstances to be shown. The district court specifically analyzed that in appellant's appendix 54, which is page 7 of the order, I mean, it specifically discusses that there has been no significant change in circumstances that's shown, and it makes a specific finding that it's not in the best interest of the child to modify custody. This court goes even further. I think that this court analyzed both 518.18d1, which is under the best interest standard, and then it went on and did an endangerment analysis as well. And in doing that endangerment analysis, it actually made very specific findings that not only it was a modification of custody not in the child's best interest, but it would actually be harmful to the child. And that, in making that finding, I think it is pretty significant that the evidence before the court not only didn't support a change in custody, but it found that it would have harmed the child. And it relies in part on some of the evidence that respondent provided regarding the child's involvement in therapy and the resistance from appellant to that ongoing therapy, or at least a lack of appreciation for the importance of that therapy. 518.18.145 does allow the district court to take into consideration facts that are not contrary to appellant's argument. I just want to note too, and I think this is important, 518.18, it actually requires a district court to retain the custodial arrangement unless it finds that a change is in the child's best interest. And if you only read appellant's affidavit, I still don't think you get to any kind of showing that it's in this child's best interest to modify custody. If anything, I think that the evidence presented in this case shows that the custodial arrangement that's presently in place is working. Both parties agree that there's a provision in the decree that while respondent has sole legal custody, she consults with and shares information about legal custody issues and as well as other issues in the child's life. And both parties agree that she had been doing that routinely. The district court made a finding about that. The agreements that respondent describes in his affidavit were actually a result of decisions that she made about legal custody issues that he didn't object to. And I don't think that those are disputed, but how those decisions came about, there was a lot of context about how difficult appellant continued to be. She also provided a lot of context about the party's poor communication that had continued. They only communicate by our family wizard. They don't have any direct communication. And she provided some pretty detailed evidence regarding the impact on the child of both appellant's behavior and how disputes between the parties would trickle down and negatively impact the child. So that was all appropriately analyzed. I just want to note that, you know, opposing counsel argues extensively that Nice v. Peterson is not applicable in this case. And there is literally no legal support for that contention. And in fact, I think a plain reading of Nice v. Peterson, Gaibe or Gieb v. Gieb, the Spanier case. I mean, these cases are very clear that in any modification request for a modification of custody under 518.18d, you have to make a prima facie showing. It doesn't exempt out 518.18d Roman numeral one situations where the parties apply the best interest standard. There's literally no support for that. With regard, you know, opposing counsel also argues appellant argues in his brief that, you know, the district court didn't make specific best interest findings. But under the Abbott v. Abbott case, that's not required. Findings are required in requests to modify custody if the district court finds that there has been a prima facie showing and orders a modification of custody. But a district court is permitted to deny a request for modification of custody without making detailed findings. I believe the theory being that because the denial is based on written submissions only, it can be reviewed based on those written submissions. And the district court is not, it's not needed for them to make detailed findings, unlike situations where they grant a request for a modification of custody based on an evidentiary hearing, and they need to make findings based on the testimony that was presented. The language in Abbott is, it actually goes through kind of a detailed analysis of when findings are required and when they're not under 518.18d situations. And it's very clear that in this case, statutory findings were not required. There's two smaller points. One is that appellant argued that the case should be either reversed or remanded because the district court didn't list a memo of law when it listed. The district court kind of went through some of the pleadings that they looked at, but they missed listing one of the memos of law. That's not, it's not even required for the district court to list the pleadings. I think that was probably a clerical oversight more than anything. And there's no evidence that that memo of law was not taken into consideration when the court made its decision. I just want to, I think it's important to note too that the standard of review requires that appellants show that there has been an abuse of discretion in the district court's denial of the modification for custody, and that the district court made findings unsupported by the evidence. I mean, my only complaint about the district court's order is it's a little thin. I would have liked more findings, but they certainly made sufficient findings that they analyzed the appropriate statute. They analyzed 518.18d. The court made a pretty detailed analysis of what a prima facie showing is, how it is required to accept the appellant's evidence as accurate, as true. It made a specific finding that there's been no significant change of circumstance, made a specific finding that a change in legal custody would not be in the child's best interest. I mean, these are the requirements that the court was required to make, and the evidence supports its findings. So I'm not seeing that there's any basis for an abuse of discretion. The court certainly applied the correct statute. So I think that the record is clear on that. And then the last thing is, if the case is remanded, there's a question of which judicial officer it would go to.
And I wanted to ask you that question, but because of the time, I was waiting until you got down. You know, it seems to be reflexive that mother all of a sudden agrees to transfer to Carver County. She's there, the child is there, father is going to be moving there. And then in the event this gets remanded, all of a sudden you're objecting and saying, have it go back to Hennepin County. What legal support do you have that it would in fact go back to Hennepin County?
I couldn't find any legal support, honestly, one way or the other. So I think this is a situation where we have to use sort of either judicial economy or common sense or reasonableness. I think it's going to be difficult, if not impossible.
But you're the one that's asking for it to go back to Hennepin County. Did I get that wrong?
Well, I mean, they're asking for it to go to Carver, and I'm saying that it makes more sense for it to stay with the if the remand is for the judicial officer to correct errors, it makes more sense for the judicial officer who made the errors to correct them. But I couldn't find any case law or a specific statute that indicated whether it would go back to Carver or back to Judge Brown in Hennepin County. I think it's a gray area. I'm gonna stop at this point. I don't have any other information.
Thank you, Ms. Novelli. Mr. Hennick?
Era, I'm unmuted. I have a couple of responses. The problem and the underpinning of respondents' entire argument is that this motion by appellant was a modification motion. And if you look specifically at what the parties crafted and the specific language of their agreement, it indicates that it was a review of the legal custody status of this child. They were represented by competent counsel. My presumption is that they made those, the language contained in the agreement was purposeful. And so respondent's entire argument is that we fail because of an application of a statute 518.18 that my client didn't agree to, nor is there support in the language of the party's agreement that supports that this should have been considered or had to be considered under as a modification. It did not. So I would have you just look at the clear terms of the party's agreement. They said the issue of legal custody may be, and they put in the word reviewed. They didn't say modified, they said reviewed. And then they put a time frame around when my client had to do that. And then they used the review several times in their agreement, and which was incorporated into the court order. So they said legal custody may be reviewed. It wasn't shall be modified, may be modified, it's reviewed, which is a de novo review by any review of that order and as found by the trial court, under the understanding is that it would be a de novo review, which takes us out of 518.18 requiring a legal burden to be met and a prima facie showing, and then the court to make findings on whether it's best or not. They're squarely under 518.17 period based upon the clear language of their agreement. So they say that in two different places on in their divorce decree in 2015, not only would be reviewed, he would have the time frame to review legal custody. If no motion is filed within that time, the right to request legal custody, joint legal custody as reviewed under the best interest standard. So respondent's entire argument is premised upon they have to meet a modification standard. This motion was a modification. I submit, Your Honor, under the clear 2015 order, which was based upon the party's agreement and incorporated, whether we like it or not, by the trial court in 2015 that says, this is what we're gonna do, which is review the custody, the designation, the joint or sole legal custody, whatever that determination should be in 2020, we're gonna review that. We're gonna look at facts as they appear at that time with fresh eyes under a de novo review. The trial court was then required under 518.17 to make every one of those findings, which counsel for respondent admits. And if you look at the 2020 court order, it's clear that the district court didn't see the need, or I don't know about see the need. They simply didn't make a finding under the 12 best interest factors. That's what these parties bargained for. And for my client and this child, and to some extent the respondent, deserve a determination based upon a best interest factor. That never occurred. That didn't occur in this case. So if we were to rewind and go back in time in 2015, that's what would have occurred. There would have been a best interest analysis based upon the facts that they knew in 2015 that says, should this be sole or joint legal custody or some combination or some other way. They never got that. My client bargained for that. The parties bargained for that. And whether they kicked the can down the road impermissibly or not, I think isn't quite before the court. They did that. I have 25 seconds. So on the remand issue, I wanted to say that this court, the trial court, changed venue. They said everything else from here on out is Carver County. If you remand this under a de novo review standard, that judge is in the same place as Judge Brown or any other district court judge would be, which is review the case under 51817 based on those facts. And my time is up, and I appreciate your time, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your briefing was helpful to the court, and we will have our decision out within the statutory framework. And that concludes.